Okay, we're back to order, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker tonight, Carl M. from Covina.
Good evening, my name is Carl, I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Ron for having me out here. And I was in the bathroom, that's where I was. And John, my friend John, was in front of me, and I said, uh-oh, there goes the gavel. You better get in there, and if I don't make it in there, you can talk. And I came out of the bathroom, and he was still standing outside the bathroom. But as I was walking up, the first person I ran into was my friend Larry, and that always gives me a comforting feeling. Larry's one of these kind of guys in Alcoholics Anonymous that's like everywhere. You can run into him anywhere in Southern California. He's one of these kind of guys in Alcoholics Anonymous that if you're talking to another friend and you say, have you seen Larry yet? You can literally say, if you stand here long enough, he'll be by. But anyway, I'm grateful to be here and grateful to be sober. I just celebrated 9 years 2 days ago, and so I'm excited about that. But and wouldn't you know it, you don't give cakes except for the last Tuesday of the month. But I'd like to welcome the new people to Alcoholics Anonymous and congratulate the CHIP people. And if you're somewhere in your first 90 days or 6 months in Alcoholics Anonymous, you may be sitting here wondering, now that I'm here in AA, what am I going to do about all my old friends? Where are they tonight? Can they get along without me? I know they're my best friends. I can't quite remember their names, but I know they're my best friends. Gosh. Maybe I could skip the meeting tomorrow night and I'll go charge my friends $20 to be designated driver. Make some money out of this staying sober thing. Maybe if you're like a lot of the young people in AA these days, you'll think, maybe I can just swing by the crack house and just hold the torch and see how their life is going. Good luck on that one. But I have some advice if you're new and you're wondering what to do about all your old friends. I recommend you give your friends a call and tell them this. Tell them that you found out you're an alcoholic, you're now an Alcoholics Anonymous, and you're trying to stay sober day at a time. Then lay this one on them and check out their reaction. Tell them this. Say, if you ever drank with me, you must be alcoholic too. Unless you find AA and quick, you will surely die. The reason I recommend you do that is because once you do that, you will have no old friends to worry about. None. They will quit calling, and you'll be left with us as your friends. You'll have a better shot at this thing called sobriety. Also, if you're new also, you may be sitting here wondering, I thought about this too. Gosh, can't I drink some near beer for the first 90 days or so? And I always figure near beer, how near do you want to get? And my logic says, I have strange logic. My logic says if I'm going to drink some near beer, I may as well go get some near pot and some near cocaine and just like nearly have a party. Wouldn't that be like the killer weekend, you know? A case full of near beer, a bag full of oregano, and then this bag full of Italian baby laxative. It's like killer weekend, wouldn't you think? Yeah. And we can read the near big book. I don't know what that would be, but I got to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 25 years old. I was burnt out in every single area of my life. I had no solution on how to live, and I had no idea how I'd ever stop drinking. No idea how I'd ever stop drinking and using. That was just unfathomable to me. And I identified with a lot when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I questioned other things. And that's pretty normal, but I was under the misperception that I needed to identify with every single thing said in an AA meeting or I was in trouble. I now know at 9 years sober that if I do identify with every single thing said in an AA meeting, then I'm in trouble. But especially some of the new meetings where I go to meetings at. But there was this one thing that a lot of people said when I was new that I just didn't identify with at all. And it wasn't true in my life, and I still don't believe it was true in my life. And I'm sure it's absolutely true in a lot of people's lives in Alcoholics Anonymous. But it was just bothering me a lot because I just didn't identify with it. So I pulled this old-timer aside. Now, I didn't know what an old-timer was. This guy was old. I didn't know that he would have the wisdom or anything like that. I just figured he'd been around for a while, so I'd ask him. And I said to him, you know, I'm hearing a lot of people say in meetings that they felt very, very different and weird as a child, even before they started drinking. And I told him, you know, I don't remember feeling different and weird as a child before I started drinking. I don't remember that at all. And he was just kind of listening and nodding his head. And I thought I needed to prove it to him further, so I told him this little story about my childhood. And I told him At 4 years old, my father had packed our whole family out of Helena, Montana, moved us all to the island of Borneo in Southeast Asia. All the other kids were Malay and Chinese. I went to a Mandarin Chinese kindergarten. I was the only white kid there, and I don't remember feeling different. He kind of looked at me and he said, "Son, we still have a problem there." Because a normal, well-adjusted child would have felt very different at that point in his life. And he was just kind of giving me that. He was giving me one of those old-timer AA messages that hits you about 2 years later, right? And that was a very valuable message. And that was that if you're looking for the differences instead of the similarities, you will find them. And if you put more emphasis on the differences instead of the similarities, you will leave Alcoholics Anonymous and die the long, slow death of an alcoholic thoroughly convinced that Alcoholics Anonymous is not for you. Over the years, I found out that, and it says it in the book again and again and again, that we're a whole cross-section of people, you know, and that people that would not normally mix, but we have one common problem. It's said at every single meeting. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other to solve their common problem. And my common problem with every single person in this whole room is alcoholism. Allergy of the body, obsession of the mind. What happens to me when I do drink, and what happens to me when I'm trying not to drink? See, and that will cross the board with everybody in this whole room. And when I really got that understood that to the core of my being, then I was able to listen very differently in Alcoholics Anonymous and be able to identify with every single person in you, no matter where you were from, what kind of background you had, what, you know, race, creed, color, religion, educational level, anything like that. You know, it just didn't matter if I'm listening for the commonality between us. Anyway, our family came back from Asia. I'm going to share what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. I do that because the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous informs me that's what I'm supposed to do. It was read tonight by Chuck. I tell you, Chuck, your voice. Did you ever make movies for grade school? It was like the voice in those grade school movies when we were listening. They'd play those movies. Next time, listen to Chuck's voice. It's amazing. But anyway, where was I? I just ran across a dead brain cell. But anyway, I'm going to show what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. That big book informs me that's what I'm supposed to do. And out of the thousands of meetings that I've been to, that's basically what everybody adheres to, what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. However, I have run across one group in Alcoholics Anonymous that sometimes deviates from that basic format of what it was like, what happened, what it's like now, and that's a Friday night Beverly Hills group on Rodeo Drive. Every once in a while, they have a tendency to share what it was like, what happened, and what they were wearing. But it's a great meeting. One time I walked in there and met some guy, and he said, "Hi, my name's Sid. I represent Bob. He's an alcoholic." Just kidding. Anyway, our family came back from Asia about 4 years later when I was about 8 or 9 years old, and I was a goofy kid by today's standards. I had short hair, I was playing violin, I was doing really well in school, and I loved my family. Now, that's a goofy kid by today's standards. And I didn't take my first drink till I was 11. I waited a while. And I only took that first drink just out of curiosity. I do not at all in any way, shape, or form remember trying to fill some sort of spiritual void in me or feeling completely apart from the rest of the world. I was just practicing violin, playing a little Hot Wheels, and thought it was a good idea to try alcohol. I'd seen it on television. I'd seen other people do it. And just out of curiosity. Now, I believe that I was an alcoholic right from the gate once I first added alcohol because of what happened to me over the next 12 hours. I was 11 years old, and my parents were out of town for the weekend, and I stole a bottle of wine from my father and locked myself in his study. And I proceeded to drink. And halfway through that first bottle of wine, I got this overwhelming sensation. It was just, I remember taking this big, deep breath. I didn't know I'd been short of breath for 11 years. It was just like, oh, man, it felt great. And then that's the last thing I consciously remember till the next morning. I came to in my bedroom and there was just puke everywhere, all over the wall, all over the floor, in the pillowcase, in my underwear, I mean everywhere. And I knew I was going to puke again, and I tried to make it into the bathroom, and I made it into the bathroom, and I realized I puked all over the bathroom, and I slipped on the floor, and I hit my head on the toilet bowl going down, and as I crawled back up, I felt that wonderful, wonderful feeling that I'd feel many times later in my life, and that is how nice and cold that porcelain feels on the side of your face. And I got my head into that toilet bowl, and I started to heave. And in between the fifth and sixth heave, I heard a voice. That voice was mine. It said, "Carl, we are going to do this again." Bam. Right there, all the components of alcoholism were active in my life. Halfway through that first bottle of wine, I got an unnatural reaction to alcohol. Phenomenon of craving kicked in. I blacked out. Next morning, in between the fifth and sixth heave, the voice was there. The mental obsession that I was going to do this again. And, you know, our book says that The mental obsession makes us forget the pain and suffering of a day, a week, a month ago. At that particular time in my life at 11 years old, I forgot the pain and suffering of just half a second ago on the last Eve, right? And I started drinking alcoholically right from the gate, as much as I could, as often as I could. And once I started drinking, it was like an overnight transition in my life, and my parents were astonished at this. Remember, I described myself as a goofy kid, short hair, playing violin, doing really well in school, loved my family. Once I started drinking, like overnight, my life changed. Out went the violin, in came the heavy metal guitar, wanted to grow my hair down to my ass, school became a very secondary issue, and my parents became the enemy immediately. A lock went on my bedroom door, black lights went up in my room, posters went up, my gods became Jimmy Page and Richie Blackmore, and my parents just went, "Wow!" You know, and I was just back behind that door going, "Wow." Two very different wows. And I'd be back behind that locked door with the black lights and posters listening to my 8-track player. This is embarrassing, but I thought 8-track players were going to be the future. this is why. I could pop in an 8-track, maybe a Led Zeppelin 8-track, get loaded, pass out, come to, and the thing is still playing around and around and around. I just thought it was the greatest thing around. And that was the summer of going into 7th grade, and a typical morning in 7th grade. We lived up in Seattle, and that was 7th grade was the beginning of junior high school. And a typical morning of school for me would be I'd show up real early, not for study hall or anything, but to meet my new friends. And we would meet out at the edge of the school property in this old beat-up building that the school didn't use anymore. It's called the Track Shack. And we would all climb into this broken part of the wall, and we'd climb in there, and some kid would bring a jar full of vodka that they'd stolen from his family. We'd be passing that around. And then, of course, it's the early 70s, so we're smoking that commercial pot. Anybody remember that stuff? Four-finger lids, $10 a bag, seeds and stems, and the whole bit. And we pack that maybe into some homemade pipe, maybe made out of plumbing fittings and a screen. Or if we were really desperate, we'd have a toilet paper roll with some aluminum foil, and we'd pack all that in there. We'd hit the lighter on it. The seeds and stems would be popping. We'd be burning holes in our clothes. And we'd wander off to school, maybe. And it's at this point that you hear a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, when they're talking from the podium, that they say, it's at this point when they mention that they smoked pot or did any drugs, they say, "I know this is AA, and I don't mean to offend anybody, but drugs are a part of my story." Ever heard that? You hear that all the time. Most bizarre example of that I've ever heard. A couple of years ago, I was in a meeting, and I heard the speaker, and he was up giving this heinous blow-by-blow drunkalogue, just ugly as can be. I mean, and the more heinous it gets, the more excited I get, and I was just right in there with him. And at one point in his story, he was saying, "You know, I had 4 DUIs, and the judge told me if I get a 5th DUI, I'm surely going to go to the state penitentiary for 5 years. And sure enough, just 2 weeks later, there I am on the freeway in a blackout and hit this family of 4. I don't even know what happened to them. I'm sure they're in the hospital, and you know, I wound up in prison for 5 years. In prison, I sodomized men. I was sodomized, and oh, I don't mean to offend anybody, but I did some drugs too." I was the only one that got it that night. I was just like... Everybody else said, "Yeah, okay, no big deal." Jeez. So anyway, when I was 14 years old, through a series of events, I'm drinking a lot, and I'm trying to control and enjoy my drinking, and I got turned on to cocaine, and I didn't know how to afford cocaine. But then I got, through a series of events, I wound up in the basement of this guy's house. He was about 30 years old, and we used to, as young teenagers, we used to read that magazine, High Times. Is that thing still out? And we would be smoking commercial pot and reading this High Times magazine, looking at all this exotic pot that we didn't even think was real. Now, I got to tell you that smoking commercial pot and reading High Times magazine is kind of like reading Playboy with a blow-up doll. It just is not, doesn't coincide. But when I was 14, I wound up in the basement of this guy's house, and I'm trying to figure it, and he opens up this hermetically sealed bag of the most incredible pot I'd ever seen. I'd only seen it in the magazine. I'm going, "Wow." And he rolled up this joint, and he took a hit, and he handed it down to me. I'm about 4'11", and I didn't know what to expect, and I took this hit, and this boom, it exploded in my lungs. I'm down on the ground barking like a dog, you know. I always called it getting high, but I wound up on the ground a lot. I handed it back up to him, and he took another hit, and I can picture it like it was yesterday. He had long, brown, greasy hair, round, rose-colored glasses. It's the early 70s, so I'm sure he was wearing bell-bottoms and platform shoes. And so he took another hit, and... And he was handing it to me, and he asked me a question that changed the course of my life at 14 years old. He said, "Can you sell any of this at school?" My eyes just went, bam, absolutely I can. And he handed me off about $500 worth of stuff, patted me on the head, and sent me on my way. Now, immediately, I became the most popular kid in the north end of Seattle. My parents' phone was ringing off the hook. Kids were lining up outside the back window. I mean, just night after night, it was just crazy. And so I was a neighborhood drunk and then a neighborhood drug dealer. And I forgot to mention, but my father was a neighborhood Lutheran minister. That's a... I wish he would have laughed at it, but he didn't. Yeah. My parents always blame my problems on people, places, and things. If we can get them away from that damn group of kids, things would be fine. Get them out of that damn public school system, things would be fine. And when I was about 17 or 18 years old, they decided that Seattle was my problem. So they decided to get me out of Seattle, and they flipped the bill and sent me across state to Washington State University. I spent 3 years at Washington State University on my parents' money, and I got about 10 credits. At any given time, my grade point average matched my blood alcohol content about a 0.25. I did absolutely nothing at that school. And by the time I was 22, this little story will let you know where I stood with my family. Now, my father is Swedish, and my mother is Icelandic, therefore I look like a polar bear. And now, I don't know whether this custom I'm about to tell you is Scandinavian or whether it's Lutheran. I don't know. But at Christmas time, my parents would not just send out Christmas cards. They would send out a big, long Christmas letter. And they would send hundreds of these out around the world to people they'd known through the years. And they would receive hundreds of them back. Now, I hadn't participated with the family hardly at all in a couple of years. But I happened to be there, and I happened to get a hold of one of these letters when I was about 22 years old. And this will let you know where I stood with my family by this time. I read this letter, and the first paragraph talked about what my parents had been doing that year, and the second paragraph talked about what the Morris children had been doing that year. And that paragraph went something like this. Our oldest daughter, Christina, just graduated with a master's degree out of Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. She's now working for the Eli Lilly Pharmaceutical Company in Indianapolis, Indiana. She traveled to Europe this summer. She did this, she did that. Her hobbies are this, this, and this. She's in the church choir. She's very happy, and we're very proud of her. Our oldest son, Eric, just graduated from Western Washington State University with a degree in advertising. He's now working for this large, prestigious advertising firm here in Seattle named McCann Erickson. He loves to golf. He loves to travel. He does this, this, and this. He's about ready to be married to this wonderful woman named Mary Lou, who works for... Oh, this will let you know how long ago this was. He's about ready to be married to this wonderful woman named Mary Lou, who works for a small company here in Seattle named Microsoft. And they travel together. They golf together. He's very happy, and we're very proud of him. Our youngest son, Carl, just turned 22. That was it. There was nothing else to say. They were actually being very kind. So anyway, it was right about that exact same time when my parents... I'd seen this look from my parents quite a few times, but this time they really, really meant it, and they took the action necessary. They said, you know, Carl... We no longer want you to be a part of this family. We know that you've been dealing drugs. We know you've been drinking like a fish. You're drunk half the time. You're destroying everything and everybody in your way. We want nothing to do with you. Turn in the house key. We don't want to see you here anymore. You're on your own. And I remember packing my car up that day, and I was going to head south. And I had had a lot of cars ever since I'd been 16 years old, and they always started out as perfectly good used cars. But they would die of alcoholism along the way. I don't know, did your cars do that? This will tell you exactly why I drank. If I were physically sober on any given morning, meaning I just haven't had a drink yet that day, and I come out of wherever I happen to be living, whether it be my parents' basement or a park, depending on what part of my life we're talking about, and I haven't had a drink yet that day, I'm a little restless, irritable, discontent, I'd twitch a little bit, and I'd walk up to a car that I've owned for a while, and I'd see the dents and the broken windows, and I'd get pissed off. I'd go, oh, God, I deserve better than this. And I'd get in and I'd smell the rancid smell of stale alcohol in the upholstery. I'd see the cigarette burns and hot box burns on the upholstery, and I'd get madder by the second. And I'd turn the key and it'd start driving. It's only hitting on one or two cylinders. And I'd drive down the road and I'd see some other young guy about my age that has a nice car, and I'd say to myself, damn it! What do I got to do to get ahead in this damn world? And all I'd have to do is go drink for a couple of hours. And after I would drink for a couple of hours, I'd walk back up to that very same car. And as I'd approach that car, I'd look at it and I'd say to myself, "What? Well, that 62 Dodge Coronet is a classic. Absolute classic." I'd get in and it wouldn't smell bad anymore. And then the most miraculous thing I ever experienced prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous would happen when I'd turn the key. I would turn the key and it's just boom. It's like a mechanic had been working on my car while I'd been drinking. This is a driving man's dream. Look at the way they send corners at 70 miles an hour. You know, 2 hours before that, I'm completely disgusted with my life. Now, why would I go do what normal people do? Now, I only use the term normal people, not that they're emotionally healthy or spiritual people. I'm talking about normal people in regards to that they do not have the same relationship to alcohol as I do. Why would I go do what normal people do when they get disgusted with their life? Because they get disgusted with their life. They reach turning points. Why would I go do what they have to do? You see, they have to go and, like, build a life. They have to go get an education, get a job, establish relationships, learn how to be in relationships, and build a better life. when they get disgusted with their life. Why would I go do all that work when I can go drink for a couple of hours and change everything? You see, they have to go do that if they want a better life, because alcohol does not do for them what it does for me. I feel sorry for them, actually. You see, but I can take a drink and change everything for a few hours. Everything. I get an unnatural reaction to alcohol. Then the problem is that this phenomenon of craving kicks in, and I wind up in jails, hospitals, and death, and then I go through the vicious cycle of trying to not drink, and then it gets too painful not to drink. I'm too restless, irritable, and discontent, and I look around and I see other people being able to drink, and I'm off, and then a vicious cycle again and again and again, back and forth. The ultimate catch-22 of alcoholism. Anyway, during this period, I just hit the streets for a while, streets of Portland, Santa Cruz, streets of Hollywood. The words are demoralizing. What a guy like me has to do to stay loaded the way I like to stay loaded. And a long story short, I was back up in the Seattle area, and these guys that I'd met from when I was supposedly going to college over there at Washington State University, these Canadian fellows came down and found me sitting on a bar stool, and they had a business proposition for me. I loved business propositions. Nothing ever worked, but I just loved to do it. And their business proposition was they wanted me to play middleman. I knew where to get pot. They had a lot of money. They couldn't get pot. They wanted me to play middleman. Now, there's three losers in any drug deal: the buyer, the seller, and the middleman. Middleman will make the least amount of money, go to jail first, and get beat up the most. I'll do that. And so I started running trunkloads of pot at the Canadian border, and every time I would be very, very drunk doing this because of the fear, trying to kill the fear. I knew I was risking 10 years of my life, 10 years of my freedom for this, for money. And I'm doing this, running up to the Canadian border, and it went great for about 6 months. And I would do it about once or twice a month, make enough money to stay loaded solid for a month, and I started to get physically very, very sick at this point in my life. At any given time I would do that, you might find me bleeding out of every orifice of my body in some hotel room, just desperately trying to get well. And about the sixth time meeting these fellows up at the Canadian border, they showed up and they didn't have the money, but they wanted me to front it to them for 24 hours. They said, just give it to us for 24 hours. It's been going good, hasn't it? Oh, yeah. And I'm just thinking, money, I need money. I fronted off to them they said they'd be back in 24 hours. It's been 11 years since I've seen them. I was in deep, deep trouble. I owed a lot of money to the wrong type of people, and I joined the Navy, is what I did. I skipped town. I thought 5 years down on a nuclear submarine is a good place for me. Now, this should scare the daylights out of you, what I'm about to tell you. But on my way into the Navy, I passed a potential test. A potential test simply measures what a person can do if they were to show up in the same place every day. That little showing up in the same place every day always eluded me. But I passed this potential test, and it should scare the daylights out of you. But that potential test qualified me to become a nuclear engineer in the Navy. That should scare the daylights out of you that the Navy was even thinking, possibly, remotely, even maybe, putting somebody like me near anything nuclear. But they made me take another test when I showed up, and I couldn't pass that test. It's called a urinalysis test. And I was immediately kicked out of the elite force of nuclear engineering and transferred over to this group of guys they called nuclear waste. And a year and a half later, I was a lower rank than when I first came into the Navy, and I was just driving my car into the base one morning with a bottle between my legs. I thought I had another driving man's dream, and I don't know I don't remember much about it, except for I know that all of a sudden, there's this long straightaway before the gate at the Navy base. I was trying to make it into the base. I think I'd been gone for a couple of days, and I'm trying to get in there. Long straightaway, and all of a sudden, there's these guard shacks at the front of Navy bases, right? And there's a Marine that stands duty, who's supposed to pull up, show your identification, checks a sticker on your car, and he will flag you forward. The best I can remember on this particular 3 seconds of my life that I wish I could change, I could just see the eyes of the Marine, and I was still going like 40 miles an hour, and I tried to swerve. I hit this meeting, the car went up on its side, and bam, right through the guard shack. As I was going over, I could still see this Marine doing this big dive out of there, and he survived. But that morning in the hospital, the Navy doctors gave me medical science's best shot at the alcoholic. It's called antabuse. And they gave me a little information about what could happen to you if you drink on antabuse, and I filed that for future reference. And I got back to my ship, and I started to count the days on this antabuse. You know, they told me I shouldn't be drinking on this stuff. I can get violently ill or die. So I started to count the days. It's been about 4 days, and I'm on antabuse. Now it's been about 6 days, and I'm on antabuse. Now it's been about 8 days. 6 hours and 15 minutes I'm on antabuse. And I'm looking around that ship, and the other guys are talking behind my back. All 300 men on that ship. It's a plot. I would try to accuse them of talking behind my back, but they would stand there looking totally innocent, thinking I'm the one that's nuts. I knew they were, though. Then they started to think behind my back. There's a friend of mine that says when people start thinking behind your back, you got to be real quick to catch them. What I was experiencing at this point is the most cunning, baffling, and powerful side of the disease of alcoholism. My inability to function on this planet in any level of comfort without a drink. And it's not that I've been feeling intermittently in between drunks ever since I've been a teenager, started to get tighter and tighter and tighter. And I was trying to figure out why is the world treating me this way? Finally realized they don't know who I am. They knew who I was, they wouldn't treat me this way. A couple of days later, my division officer asked me to do something very legitimate, like swab the passageway, that's like mop the hallway, and I let him know. I couldn't believe he had asked me to do that. Of course, I was the lowest ranking man in the whole division. But I let him have it. I just said, "You obviously don't know who I am, do you?" He looked me right in the eye and he said, "Okay, who are you?" That was the single most embarrassing question I'd ever been asked in my whole life. I never thought anybody would ask me to tell them. But I felt that way my whole life. The paranoia and the anger and the frustration got too much, and I just kept on thinking, okay, the doctor said you can get violently ill or die if you drink on antabuse, one of these two things. So I went AWOL from the ship and locked myself in a hotel room with a bottle of vodka and a shot glass to find out which reaction I would have. So I took one shot. Nothing happened. Authority had lied to me again. I waited about 2 minutes to make sure, and I took another shot. I started to feel tingly in the face, so I looked at myself in the mirror, and I was like bright red and purple all over my face. I was like, oh. I took another shot. I looked at my shirt. I was drenched in sweat. I could feel my heart go boom, boom, boom. And all of a sudden, I was like, hyperventilating. We're doing all right so far. This is all right. We're all right. This is a very sick group. It's not funny. I took another shot, and up it came. My sponsor, Eddie C., calls this projectile regurgitation. Just straight across the room. Thank God I was in the type of hotel room where the toilet's in the same room as the bed. You know, we've all had a lot of practice at socially throwing up. You know, all through our lives, these are tools for living that we get out there. You know, you get a little sour taste in the back of your throat, maybe a little bit comes up in your mouth, and you kind of go, excuse me, and you just come back, you got any mints, you know, you just carry on. You don't let little thing, you don't go home after something like that. But here it was getting pretty ugly. But I found the magic of antabuse, that if you don't die, which I almost did a couple of times, I wound up in the hospital a few times, if you don't die, and you keep drinking, and you keep puking, and you keep drinking, and you keep puking for about 2 hours, enough of the antabuse would kick out of my system so I would quit throwing up, and I would just be left with red face, hyperventilating, and sweating. And I already told you, I'm all right with that. So I did this little song and dance once, sometimes twice a week for 7 months. On my last night of drinking, I was being let out of the San Diego jail by the shore patrol. And I always used, whenever I got picked up, I'd be in civilian jail, and then all of a sudden, I'd be trying to come out of it, and I wouldn't have known what really went on, and then I'd see the shore patrol, and the feeling was always, oh, damn, that's right, I'm in the Navy.
Please turn it over.
The shore patrol, and the feeling was always, oh, damn, that's right, I'm in the Navy. Oh, shit. You know, and you got to deal with a whole other set of authorities. But on this last night, I've been let out of the San Diego jail again, being brought back to the ship, and just 2 weeks before that, I'd been left for dead in a motel parking lot. I had wound up in the hospital. They had to, they had 28 stitches in my face. They had to do reconstructive surgery to set my jaw back. I had just been left for dead in a pool of blood. I still remember that night, kind of laying there in the motel parking lot, feeling blood. I didn't know it was blood. I just felt a lot of moisture all over me. And I remember there was nobody else there. I'd just been left by three men, just beat the living tar out of me. And I remember hearing the sirens off in the background. And for the very first time ever in my whole life, as I laid there and listening to those sirens, I remember thinking, I hope those sirens are for me. I had never thought that about sirens before. Whenever I heard sirens, I'm going, oh, damn, I hope they're not for me. Dashing, but that particular night, and there was just a week later. I'll tell you, this is my alcoholic mind. That morning, after I got out of surgery and had my face reconstructed, my jaw was wired shut, 28 stitches, this side of my face was out there, arm was in a sling. As I was walking out of the hospital that particular morning, when a friend came to pick me up, I said to my friend, I said, you know what? If there's any time I need a drink, it's now. You know, that's the way my mind works. And so I was being led up to the shore patrol, and I was a real mess, and they had already processed orders on me. And those orders said, 90 days in the brig, bad conduct discharge, or treatment. Now, I fell into this tiny little window of opportunity, what I call it, in early 1987, late 1986, that the Uniform Code of Military Justice did not allow the military to discharge somebody for alcohol-related offenses without giving them treatment first. Very soon after that, just about 9 months later, that changed to where you would be discharged first and then offered treatment in your hometown VA hospital. Anyway, I was turned around and marched up to this treatment center up at Miramar. That's where the top gun school was. Our little section was called Top Drunk. And, you know, the only thing I remember about the first few days is we all sort of sat around in this big group and we were waiting to be assigned a counselor, I guess. And there's everybody was kind of sitting there. Nobody's really doing much. We have an assistant facilitator kind of looking out over us to make sure nobody went into seizures or, you know, spontaneously combusted or something. And we're kind of sitting there, and this one guy, on about the second day, his name was Paco, came from some other base, and all of a sudden Paco raises his hand, this group. He goes, you guys, I hear this is a program of rigorous honesty. All of us are going, yeah, and he's going, my name's really not Paco. Paco's just a street name I had ever since I was a young teenager, and I want you guys to call me by my real name. My real name's Randy. If I'm going to do this staying sober thing with you guys, I'd really like to be called Randy. And we're all just going, yeah, whatever, guy. And this assistant facilitator got all excited. Said, my God, there's the first breakthrough of any honesty of any of you SOBs. Slapped a gold name tag on him and told him, whenever we're not around, you're in charge. I hated Randy. I hated him from that second forward. And he and I were butting heads back and forth. And I remember sitting there in that treatment center thinking, you know, well, they're talking about what seems to be not drinking. I can't do that, but I'll hang for a bit. They're mentioning what seems to be like therapy or psychiatry. That doesn't work for me because I've been sent to psychiatrists by my parents for years, and the Navy had been sending me to psychiatrists quite a bit in the last 2 years. That doesn't work. And they were talking, and I also heard them mentioning God. And I knew God doesn't work for me because if anybody should have it, I'm a Lutheran minister's son, I should have it carte blanche, right? And none of it had worked, and I'm just saying, you know, whatever. On the seventh day, they took us all to our first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. At least it was my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got to tell you, my first impression of Alcoholics Anonymous was a very positive one. There's about 10 of us sailors kind of sitting in the back at this participation meeting. It was about this size. And I remember my head is just spinning. What are they doing? What is this place? What are they doing? They're reading something. Oh, my God. Okay. And I really remember out of that meeting is that I identified with what people were saying. These people must have been sharing responsibly. Probably 10 to 12 people shared for 3 to 5 minutes. They must have been talking about alcoholism and Alcoholics Anonymous because I identified with little pieces of what they were talking about. I remember this one guy. The one thing that I really remember is this one guy got called on and he walked all the way to the front of the room, introduced himself. He said one sentence and he sat down. And my head was just spinning and I'm catching little bits here and there. And this guy gets up and says, my name's Jack. I'm an alcoholic. My mind would have killed my body a long time ago, except it needed it for transportation. And he sat down. And I just remember going, whoa. I remember falling all the way back to his chair like he was some sort of deity or something. I'm just going, see, and I felt great for about 11 seconds. I now know why I felt great. It was like identification. I immediately identified with this guy and I'm like, looking at him. Now, it only lasted 11 seconds because Randy had my cigarettes and wouldn't give me one. The next night, we went to another meeting and I got really confused at this meeting. Everybody at this meeting was talking about something I didn't understand at all. Everybody was up there saying they had a drug of choice. They were saying my drug of choice was, or my drug of choice is, and I'm going, drug of choice? Now, I'd been around the block a few times. I'd never heard anybody mention the word drug of choice. I'd never heard of that. And so I was sitting there thinking, drug of choice? Was I supposed to choose out there? Did I do something wrong? Maybe I'm supposed to choose now. What are they talking about? So next morning in our group little thing, I asked my counselor. Her name was Mary Weber, a non-alcoholic, wonderful woman, probably saved my life for a lot of reasons, and she was excellent at what she did, and a non-alcoholic. I don't know why anybody that's not alcoholic would want to work with us, but she did, and she was good at it. And I remember saying that next morning, I said, Mary, last night in the meeting they were talking about something called a drug of choice. Now, I'm really confused. What in the hell do they mean by that? She said, "Carl, let's play a little game." She used to like to say, "Let's play a game." She said, "If I walked into this room and I had a tray," I said, "Okay, you walked in the room, you had a tray." She said, "And on that tray, I had a bottle of Jack Daniels, an ounce of cocaine, and an ounce of Thai sticks. Which one would you take?" I started to drool immediately. Just like totally off in fantasy land. She said, "Well, which one would you take?" I said, "I'd take them all." "You know, Carl, play the game. You can only have one. Which one would you take?" And I'm going, "Shit. I guess if I can only have one, Mary, I'd take the ounce of cocaine." She said, "Well, then maybe cocaine is your drug of choice. Do you understand now?" I said, "No." She said, "What's the problem?" I said, "Well, Mary, the only reason I take the ounce of cocaine over the other two is, well, I'd take that ounce of cocaine, I'd get the hell out of here, I'd sell 2 8-balls so I'd have enough money to buy a quarter pound of Thai sticks and a case of Jack Daniels. That's what I would do." Now, I didn't know that I learned this, but I'm so grateful that I learned this very important point of Alcoholics Anonymous and any other 12-step program that deals with drugs or anything. And that is that the message is clean and sober across the board. We do not differentiate between the two as to calling our sobriety date. You ever run across new people and you ask them, say, "How long have you been sober?" And they say, "Well, my drinking sobriety date is January 4th. My pot sobriety date is March 3rd. Oh, I blew my methamphetamine date last night." And, they're carrying like 3 or 4 sobriety dates. No. Didn't work. You hear funny things from new people. The funniest thing I heard lately from a new guy, I saw this guy around for a while and I asked him, "Say, how long you got now?" He goes, well, "I had 90 days, but I drank last night, so now I have 89 days. I didn't quite know what to say. I was going, "Huh?" It's pretty good thinking, very alcoholic thinking, I thought. So anyway, after 45 days, you're going to let me out of this treatment center. They're, of course, not happy with my progress. The prognosis, going back to the ship's doctor, just to put it in light terms, it said, "Chances of staying sober." Good luck. But in the last couple of days before they let us out after 45 days, in the last few days, they gather all 35 of us up that we're going to get out on this Friday, and they get the biggest, meanest counselor up in front of us, and he panned the room, and he said, "We've been here for years, and statistics through the years have shown us that only one out of you 35 will find continuous sobriety from this day forward. Only one of you 35 will stay continuously sober from this day forward." And I remember thinking, damn, if only one of us is going to make it, I know it's not going to be me. We all know who it's going to be. It's going to be Randy over here, guaranteed. In 45 days, he's turned in term papers on acceptance. It's like the poster boy of recovery. On this Friday afternoon, they let us all out, and there's about 4 or 5 of us kind of standing out on the front doorsteps of this treatment center and kind of fidgety. Our sea bags are there. They're bringing cars out of impound, out of the Navy impound lot. They've been transferred over. And when they brought my car out of impound, I was so successful when I used to get loaded is that when they brought my car out of impound, they brought out my Rolls Canardly. That's the kind of car that rolls down one hill and Canardly make it up the next. It's a 68 Volkswagen with a hole in the floorboard, 39 dents, 2 broken windows, and I had to push start the thing. Anyway, there's about 4 of us out there, and I'm thinking, God, only one of us is going to make it. It's going to be Randy, and, shit. All of a sudden, we hear these screeching tires over in the other corner of the parking lot. I guess Randy got out about a half hour before the rest of us for turning in his gold name tag or something, and he's driving right at us, about 25 miles an hour, and we, wow, that's Randy. All of a sudden, he pulls up a bottle. He's pounding down his bottle, rolls down the window, throws the bottle right at the treatment center, crash, drives by us, gives us all the finger, and whoosh, there he goes. I guess his name was Paco again. I don't know. Next thing I consciously remember, I must have gone back to my ship to deliver my orders, but the next thing I really remember is that I showed up at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, the North Shore Alano Club, Pacific Beach, north of San Diego, and the 6 o'clock gong show meeting. Now, I'm sitting there in the back of that meeting. The truth about my life is I'm 45 days without a drink or a drug. I've got a lot of information. And I'm in the best physical condition I've been in years. Very, very dangerous. I had no idea that I was still dying of the disease of alcoholism and didn't even know it. Feeling better than I had physically, with information, and a little bit of a clear head. Very dangerous. One guy operating in his, and also all I ever wore whenever I left that base, I would stop by a gas station and change clothes and put a bunch of mousse and hairspray in my hair. I'd put it all in different directions. I wore long dangly earrings, black leather pants, black leather jacket, black tank top, black boots, put on some sunglasses, long dangly earrings. And a friend of mine told me at that point in my life I was suffering from what he calls IRS problems. It's imaginary rock star is what that is. And I'd slink around meetings and that. But that night I'm sitting there in the back and You know, very first meeting out of treatment, and I don't know what's going on. And that one guy operating on his primary purpose that night leaned over to me and said, "Say, never seen you here before. What are you doing?" I didn't think quick enough to lie to him, and I said, "You know, I just got out of this treatment center, and I don't know what I'm doing." This guy's eyes went bing. Big smile went across his face, and I started wondering, what part of town am I in here? And I now know what got him so excited about meeting me. Two reasons. First reason is this guy had just run across the rare occasion in Alcoholics Anonymous where he met a newcomer who accidentally admitted he didn't know what he was doing. That got him real excited. The other thing that got him so excited, it was something in particular going on in this man's life at that time that made him especially glad to meet me. He was about a year and a half sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. He was doing the drill. He was going to a lot of meetings. He was doing, you know, doing what he needs to do and had a sponsor. And well, that was Friday night. The night before, the woman he'd been dating ever since he'd been brand new had left him for another man in Alcoholics Anonymous. So he was sitting there Friday night wondering what to do with his weekend. Homicide, suicide, get loaded, or grab this newcomer. He was like all over me all weekend long. We went to like 18 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that weekend. And this guy was just crazy about this woman all weekend. At one point he got called on to read chapter 5 by one of his friends, and he got up there and he said, "Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves a simple program. Usually women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves." And in between the meetings, he'd throw me into the passenger side of his car and he'd start driving and he'd start yelling at me. He'd be driving along, he'd say, "You gotta go to meetings, you gotta read the book, you gotta get a sponsor, god damn that bitch! You gotta go to meetings, you gotta read the book, god damn her!" So I was getting a little AA introductory relationship counseling there. The fact of the matter is that man's reaction to his pain that night saved my life. Had he not done what he did that night, I would have wandered out the back of that meeting. I wouldn't have talked to anybody. I wouldn't have known to go to another meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know that people went to more meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous than one or two in a blue moon. I had no clue. And by going to so many meetings in the same area of town with this guy, I learned something so valuable about Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember on Saturday noon, we're on about our seventh meeting. I look across the room and there's that group of guys that were, you know, they say they got years of sobriety, and they were at the Friday night meeting the night before. Here they are, another meeting, Saturday noon. Wow. Sunday morning, we're on about our 13th meeting. Look across the room, and there's that beautiful old couple that each took a 30-year cake the night before at Saturday night. Here they were, Sunday morning, another meeting. Wow. I didn't know that people went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis. That might have explained why you guys all knew each other's names, but I didn't put that together. I had no clue. What I learned about how we go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm going to correlate to a football game. I don't watch much football. I do like to watch football if Seattle's in a championship game. Haven't watched football much lately. But see, a football team is there to win the game. That's their whole point. They're there to win the game. And how do they do that? They huddle up and they do one play. They huddle up and they do one play. Around here in Alcoholics Anonymous, we kind of do the same thing. And the game around here is one day without a drink. And what do? We run in here and we huddle up. We go, "Remember, we're bodily and mentally different from our fellows. Break!" And we go out there and we try a little of this, do a little of that, do a little of this, and we run right back in here and we huddle up. We go, "Remember, we're bodily and mentally different from our fellows." And just before we break, some guy in the corner might go, wait, before we break, "I need to tell you, been here for 6 months. I'm broken, I'm bored. What do I do?" Some old-timer will look over his glasses and say, "Get a job! Break!" And we go out there and we try a little of this, do a little of that, run right back in and we huddle up. We go, "Remember, we're bodily and mentally different from our fellows." And just before we break, some woman might go, "Wait, this is really embarrassing because I've been here for 8 years. But my boyfriend has the keys to my car, the keys to my condo, my ATM card, my ATM code, has my checkbook, and he's sleeping with all the other women in Alcoholics Anonymous. What do I do?" Some old-timer woman will put down her knitting and say, "Get rid of the bastard! Break!" And we go out there and we try a little of this, do a little of that. You see, I got to be in here at the same time as remembering that I'm bodily and mentally different from my fellows out there. I need to remember that I'm bodily and mentally similar to you in here. You see, that's just as important. I need to know that I'm bodily and mentally similar to you in here, and I need to know how to learn to live from you. It's bizarre. The facts about my life are that for years, my parents had paid for very, very well-educated psychiatrists. Wonderful psychiatrists, I'm sure. Well-meaning, highly paid. Other minister friends of my father's had tried to help me. Coaches, teachers, all sorts of society's best people had tried to teach me how to live. Couldn't hear a word they said. I walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Some guy gets up and talks for 45 minutes about what a loser he's been his whole life. And I go, "Whoa,
this guy can teach me how to live. You know, it's the most bizarre thing. It's the most bizarre thing. It says, you know, the ex-problem drinker in our book, it says the ex-problem drinker, properly armed with facts about himself, can gain the entire confidence of another alcoholic within a few hours. It's an amazing thing. It's an amazing, amazing thing. That's how a plumber can save the life of a nuclear physicist. Because we share a common problem and a common solution. And so anyway, after that, I started to go to a lot of meetings. My first sponsor was another guy on the ship, the one other recovering alcoholic on the ship. And he hunted me down the day I walked on that Monday morning after being at that barrage of meetings. He hunted me down, and he was just like all over me too. I had no idea what he was really doing and why he was doing it. I had no idea why he was so interested in me. He was desperately trying to stay sober himself. Right? I had no idea. I thought he was just like bothering me is what it was. And he was just all over me. And he'd be checking in with me like three times a day. And I'd be just losing it in the shop. And he'd pull me aside and he'd start talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know that he was talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. He was just talking to me. And he was trying to stay sober himself. I had no idea that's really... Because later on he told me, you know, Carl, I didn't think you were going to make it at all. I had no hopes that you were going to make it. You were a nutcase. And he just kept doing it and kept doing it. He was trying to stay sober himself. And, you know, he was only a year and a half sober himself. But he had a sponsor with like 10 years. And that's how the message was carried to me through him. He told me later that he spent a lot of time on the phone saying, okay, to his sponsor, okay, what do I do with the guy now? You know, and then he'd be doing what his sponsor told him to do with me. And, you know, that's how the message of Alcoholics Anonymous was carried to me. And I remember we started to go to a lot of meetings, a lot of meetings, a lot of meetings. And then all of a sudden, after about 90 days, I'm like dying inside again. Total, and in between meetings, I'd just be going, God, what's wrong with me? Now I'm not drinking, and I'm in this AA thing, and I still can't understand what's going on with me. And I remember going back and yelling at my first sponsor, you know, it was you, they, and them. Always you, they, and them. They are doing this to me. They don't understand. It's you guys again. Damn, you know. I said, Carl, have you read the book yet? You've had the book for about 90 days. Have you read it yet? And I said, well, yeah, I mean, I've been to a lot of meetings. Some of them have been book studies. Yeah, I've read it. There's like How It Works, We Antagonists, some doctor with some opinion about something. If you would ask me at that point who wrote the doctor's opinion, I would have tried to be smart. And I would have said, well, Dr. Bob. There's a doctor. Dr. Bob. Oh, yeah, must have. No clue. No clue. And you see, if I don't understand what the big book talks about, In describing what it means to be alcoholic, allergy of the body, obsession of the mind, there is no possible way for me to work the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous. No possible way. Just sitting in a meeting saying, hi, I'm Carl, I'm an alcoholic, but not even knowing what that really means, I could do wonderful inner work for years after that. I could go make amends, I can do all sorts of stuff, I could go to therapy and therapy, I could do wonderful stuff. If I don't have that first step, I'm a dead man. For an alcoholic of my type, I'm a dead man. And I needed to know why I was powerless over alcohol. That once I take a drink, I have an abnormal reaction to alcohol, phenomenon of craving kicks in. Once I try to stop drinking, I have a mind that will lie to me again and again and again. It will take me right back to that first drink. It will be cunning, baffling, and powerful, new excuses every single time, back to the first drink. Then the phenomenon of craving kicks in, and I'm in an ultimate catch-22 of the alcoholic life. I cannot stay sober, and I cannot drink successfully. And I'm doomed to the alcoholic death unless I have an entire psychic change, spiritual awakening, or just a personality change sufficient to recover from alcoholism. And that personality change or spiritual awakening, simply what it did for me was that I was able to now differentiate the true from the false, whereas I couldn't. It was just that simple, that I could differentiate the true from the false in regards to my relationship to alcohol and drugs. Now, once I'd done step one, I started, you know, it said, now we're going to deal with this God thing. This is a problem for me. So I started asking everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous what God was. Now, I'm doing it completely backwards. If I would just take the steps, because I did believe there was a God, and the book says, you know, if I'm just willing to believe in a power greater than myself, we emphatically assure the man he's on his way now. But I'm just going around asking everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous what's God, and I'm getting... One beautiful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is we do not define God. It's wonderful. But in this 100 people we got in here, we got 100 different conceptions of a power greater than ourselves. Beautiful. Very confusing for the newcomer who's wandering around asking everybody what's God. The more I asked, the more confused I got, and then all of a sudden the light bulb went on. Bing! Very dangerous for me. But I thought, my father, he's been a Lutheran minister for 40 years. I'll call him up, he'll tell me what God is, I'll straighten out these people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Very walk on an eggshell relationship with my parents at this point, and I called up my dad, and I said, Dad, you've been a minister and a theologian for 40 years. You spent your whole life studying about, talking about, preaching about God. You've got to tell me, what's God? He said, "Carl, how long has it been since you had a drink?" I said, "Well, it's been about 100 and some days." He said, "Well, then, Carl, God is whatever got you to those people in Alcoholics Anonymous. For Christ's sake, do what they say." That was it. No, and I mean, I tried to impress my parents a little bit in these phone conversations. You know, I tried to impress my mom with Alcoholics Anonymous one night, break the ice on the conversation, said, "Mom, you wouldn't believe what they said in the meeting tonight. It was incredible. They told me if I don't take the first drink, I won't get drunk." There was silence on the other end of the line. After a few seconds, she said, "Bunch of philosophers. They're in that AA program, huh?" See, but just a couple hours before that, when I heard it at the meeting, I almost fell out of my chair. It was like life-changing news to me. Big news. I don't understand those non-alcoholics. And you know, I fought with my parents a lot trying to make them understand alcoholism and me now. And it was a major turning point in my relationship to them when I learned it's not their job to understand me, it's my job to understand them. And for me to make amends and for me to rebuild a relationship, not sit around waiting for them to rebuild a relationship. I'm the one that needs to. You see, they don't need a program. They're actually very successful people, emotionally, spiritually, financially successful people. They're having a ball at life. I just got to go meet them down in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico last week. I just had a wonderful time with them. Alcoholics Anonymous completely repaired my relationship with my family. Completely repaired it. And I'm so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. And Alcoholics Anonymous has repaired every other area of my life by my following what's in this book. I haven't done anything else but what's in this book. Taking the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, taking them like my life depends on it, and being of service to others. Now, it took me a while to start really getting into service. When I got out of the Navy after 2 years sobriety, it took I hadn't really ever had a commitment at a meeting. It's nobody's fault, really. The ship had to go out to sea all the time, and I wound up in meetings all over the world. I mean, that was a wonderful, wonderful experience. I mean, except for when you're trying to scream at a taxi driver that doesn't understand English, and you're trying to say, "Alcoholics Anonymous!" You know, and then you get there, and it's a Spanish-speaking meeting. You know, and you sit there anyway. And but after 2 years, I got out of the Navy, and I came up here to the Los Angeles area, and I came up here to go to school. I did not go to school thinking I needed to do something to better my life. I went to school because my first sponsor's sponsor told me because I had blown 3 years of my parents' money on getting a degree, I either had to pay them back or go get what they paid for in the first place. I immediately started checking into VA benefits and looking into school. And I came up here simply to make amends to my parents by going to school. And I got up here, and that's when I got the sponsor I have today, Eddie C. And that man has changed the course of my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I started to follow him around. He's 44 years sober now. And that first time I ever heard him speak, he got up there and he said, "You know, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1951. Nobody understood me. You know, I was trying to tell these people that I was dropping Reds, and they thought I was killing communists." You know, I was like, excellent, this is the man for me. Then he said, "And I tried to tell him, talk about uppers, and they thought I meant teeth." You know, nobody understood him, but he stayed here anyway. He was one of the young, you know, 1951, being 30 years old in Alcoholics Anonymous or something. But he got me to start working with new people, start putting new people in my car. I still had that Volkswagen with the hole in the floorboard that had push start, and he told me that if I put newcomers in my car, my life would get better. I didn't see how that would work, but I did it anyway. Put some newcomers in my car, and I push started my car, went down to the local club, picked up a few new guys, went out to this meeting, and the very first night, I realized Eddie did not lie to me. My life got better the very first night. They could push start my car for me. Just got better. My life has taken off in directions I never knew were possible for a man like me. It's all a direct result of a loving God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Bottom line why I stay is because if I were to get loaded, the best thing from that second forward, the best thing that could possibly happen to me is I'd make it back. So why leave in the first place? Why leave in the first place? And I need to know what I need to do to stay here. And it was talked about at this meeting. I really like that. Unity, recovery, service. If I can do those three things, I get to stay. If I don't, it's like teetering on a three-legged stool, missing one or two legs. And I got to have all three of those in my life, and I can keep a reasonably balanced, somewhat sane life. I still like a little insanity, a little color, a little craziness. Anybody who doesn't have at least one mental breakdown a year in Alcoholics Anonymous, don't trust them. But I do love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm grateful to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, Carl. Okay, I want to thank Sharon for reading chapter 3, Chuck for reading chapter 5, Armando for the 12 traditions, and thank again Carl for sharing this. And I want to, let's see, what do I want to do? Somewhere in here, oh, a vision for you. We've asked Don to read a vision for you.
My name is Don, and I am an alcoholic. A vision for you. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you till then.
Okay, thank you all for coming tonight. You're cordially invited to return next week when our meeting will be led by another sober alcoholic, and our speaker will be Gloria D. from Long Beach. And after a moment of silent meditation for the alcoholic who's still suffering, would Kay, would you lead us in a closing prayer?
This is recorded January the 23rd, 1996, at Arbor Road Speakers Meeting.
This is a Caskey recording.
For copies of this and other tapes, write P.O. Box 15818, Long Beach, California, 90815.